You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. On April 23, 2015, Beth Parnitza presented the fifth in our six-part CPN Thursday series entitled The Civil War Through Different Lenses. In this podcast, Ms. Parnitza shares her personal memories of 4 years of sesquicentennial visiting and tour leading, a review of Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park's 4 commemorations, as well as a look at the broader picture of trying to understand what the sesquicentennial was about and what it means to us now and in the future. Beth Parnitza is an historian with the National Park Service at the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park, where she supervises the Chancellorsfield Battlefield Center and manages volunteers and social media. A 2011 graduate of West Virginia University, her research interests focuses largely on the human element of the Civil War, particularly in understanding the steps taken by individuals toward a harder kind of war and their motivations to do so. The lecture series was organized by award-winning historian and Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer Rick Britton in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Our podcast is entitled A Sense of the Sesquicentennial. Here's Beth Parnitza.
All right. Well, first I'd like to start off by saying thank you to everyone for having me back again. I can't believe this is my fourth time here, and you guys are a fabulous group every time, so I'm always thrilled to come back. So glad that Rick continues to ask me back. My title today for our talk is A Sense of the Sesquicentennial, A Park Ranger Ruminates, and you can thank Rick for the alliteration there. I'm not so clever. But ruminates is an excellent word to use for this, so I'm going to ask you to bear with me because we're going to cover a lot of ground. We're going to bounce between my personal reminiscences of 4 years' worth of sesquicentennial visiting and tour leading to a little bit of a focus on my park, Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Parks, 4 commemorations, as well as just the broader picture and trying to understand what the sesquicentennial was, what it means to us, and what its history may be in the coming years. So, to start off, if we want to advance the slide. All right. So this is just an image from our commemoration, and I wanted to ask you all, how many of you have been to a sesquicentennial program of any kind? All right. I figured a lot of you probably had. And so the things that I want you to think about are things that would have been questions I hope you asked yourself as you visited one of these sesquicentennial programs. One of them is to ask, what do these commemorations tell us about society? So what does it say about us that we want to remember these events from 150 years ago? And then also, what does it tell us about how we look at the past? So how do we view the events of 150 years ago within the context of the time that's passed? So again, let's talk a little bit about the big picture goals that we had from our park. We had an emphasis from our park on real-time programs. We wanted to be able to put people in a place and say, 150 years ago, at this very moment, this was happening. Because we think that 150 years is really kind of an arbitrary time, isn't it? It's the same as 151 years. And every time I pointed that out, I got this look from everyone else around the park, like, well, thanks, Beth, for spoiling our sesquicentennial. But at the same time, it really is. But when you can say very definitively a round number like 150 years ago is when this happened, it seems to mean a little bit more. And so we wanted to get people out in the places at that time that things were happening. We wanted our programs to be thoughtful, sometimes somber, because much as we just discussed about the visiting a place of a hanging, you're visiting a battlefield. This is not really a cheerful place. We want people to enjoy themselves, but we also want them to get a sense of why is this place important? Why does it matter? And why it matters isn't the most cheerful subject around. We thought both of those would give our visitors an authenticity of experience. And you'll hear me use the word authenticity a couple times in this program. So I hope you pay attention to that. It really did seem to mean a lot to people that they were getting an experience on the real place at the real time. We wanted to use the words of witnesses and participants, more so than our words. They're more important than our words in many ways. We wanted to tell a broad, complex story. We noticed in years past, that, especially decades past, that our story hadn't always been broad. It hadn't always been complete. And a lot of people will look at our programs and say, well, I see you've checked all of your boxes to be politically correct. And I would always say, no, you'll see we've checked our boxes to be historically correct. Because all of our story is important, even the ones that have been overlooked for years. We also wanted to have participatory events. We know that it's important to people to feel like they're a part of their history. And so we wanted to draw them in and say, here's something that you can actively do to remember, to commemorate these events. So you'll notice we had a lot of goals. And it might be up to you all to decide whether we actually met them or not. We also, one last one I see snuck in here, to engage a new generation in our complex past. We wanted to see kids out on the field. We wanted to see adolescents out on the field. We wanted to see people my age out on the field, as well as people of an older generation. So we wanted to get everybody out onto the field. So as we look at the sesquicentennial, though, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't jump back 50 years and take a look at the centennial. So in a little bit of a different vein, we see Stonewall Jackson here with a remarkable looking beard during the centennial of the Civil War. So this is from the reenactment of the First Battle of Manassas in 1861. And the Civil War centennial had a lot of different characteristics to it. How many of you participated in a centennial programs? Just one. Oh, it's important to remember also the centennial commemoration kind of within the context of its time. It was a time of consensus history, which is a word that we throw around a lot. It basically means that historians were interested in agreeing with each other all over the place. And we wanted a past that was easier to use. We wanted a past that told us more about our commonalities and about the things that made us a great nation. Not that that's necessarily a problem, but that is the focus of the centennial, was on what binds us together rather than what pulled us apart. And in many ways that makes sense because it's happening during the Cold War. So you want that sort of national unity. You want that focus on what brings us together. Yes, sir?
A question on the centennial. Did the Park Service allow reenactments on the exact battlefield then?
All right, so the question is, did the Park Service allow reenactments on the battlefield then? And the answer is yes. This image is of that reenactment. And actually, that's what sparked the change in policy. Because when you have a massive reenactment taking place on the actual battlegrounds, the aftermath of this reenactment was incredible. You allow horses out onto the battlefield. You allow soldiers to be using the original positions. They're going to churn up the dirt. They're going to tear up the entire battlefield. They're going to leave behind all sorts of detritus that is then going to get mixed into the archaeological record. And it really makes a mess. And so that's one of the reasons that we no longer allow reenactments on the battlefield. So anyone who is a fan of those thinks centennial. But it did also come to mind. I mean, if you take a look at this image, Stonewall Jackson honestly looks a little bit laughable, to me at least, in this picture. And that sort of also reminds us of what we want to do differently since the centennial. We want to take a different sort of approach to things, which is part of why it's important to look at the centennial. But again, so their focus is on what brought us together, or was on what brought us together. And it makes sense in a lot of ways. A lot of times we'll look back and say, well, why didn't you talk about civil rights issues? You know, they're happening right on your doorstep. What better way to talk about slavery in the Civil War? But think about how many people would have turned out and or what your expressions might be if I decided to come in today and talk about Ferguson. Yeah, you might have looked at me a little bit differently, or our conversation would be very, very different. So I can, to some degree, understand why our predecessors avoided these things, especially, again, at a time of national unity. You also have this sort of era of consumerism taking place in the 1960s. So a lot of people, when you ask them what their memory of the centennial was, they were kids, and so they remember toy soldiers, and they remember the reenactment, and they remember all these things that they could take in quickly and then take home with them, that they could buy and bring home. And so when you look at the commemorative programs, then we see a reenactment taking place on the battlefield. We see a national commission that's trying to bring together groups for celebratory events. We wanted to celebrate the time that had passed and the unity that had developed since the Civil War. So that the 1960s commemorations are often seen as celebrations. That's going to be a very distinct difference between the centennial and the sesquicentennial. But locally, And interestingly, when I took a look at what was done for the centennial around our park, since we're going to be focusing on that a lot for the sesquicentennial, it turns out we didn't do an awful much at all. We pretty much had a few ceremonies. We had rededications of a couple monuments, and we opened brand new exhibits, which in itself would have been a huge undertaking. So locally, our efforts were pretty small in the Fredericksburg area. But I think it's fairly typical to say that you weren't going to see these sort of real-time tours out on the field for the centennial. You're going to see ceremonies and rededications. And again, things that bring us together, celebrations. And so we started to look at the centennial, and there's an excellent book called Troubled Commemoration that if you want to learn more about the centennial and its successes and failures, I highly recommend. But it went and took a very close look at the centennial and said, what did we do right and what did we do wrong? And one of the main lessons was that we needed a more complex and a more diverse commemoration. We needed something that told a broader story. We needed to look at things that pulled us apart rather than things that brought us together necessarily. We needed to include the causes of the war. We needed to include stories like slavery. We needed to basically tell a better, broader story. And instead of celebrating the Civil War, the loss of 750,000 people, we should probably commemorate it and not celebrate it. So as we go along, I also want you to think then, despite all the good lessons that we learned from the centennial, I want you to think about how the centennial colored our sesquicentennial. Sometimes I wondered, I'd sit back and in our staff meetings, wonder if we weren't overcompensating in some places, saying, oh, but look what the centennial did. We can't do anything like that. We're going to go to the complete polar opposite. Or did we do the right thing? Did we learn all of the lessons that we needed to from the centennial? So there's good and bad that we can draw from Jackson on his horse up here. But again, things to think about as we start off. So as we move through the early phases of the sesquicentennial. For most of us, if we attended the very first events, I didn't make it to Fort Sumter, but I did make it to First Manassas, and I can tell you that my primary memory is that it was really, really hot, about 120 degrees heat index at First Manassas, 150th, but happily later commemorations were graced with better weather. I like this one at Antietam, and I would still put this in kind of the early stages of the sesquicentennial. And things were colored pretty much by having really huge crowds, especially at the big name events, so Manassas, even to some degree 7 days, Antietam. We saw these massive crowds turning out. This is for the all-day hike that took place on September 17th at Antietam, and there were 600 people on the one all-day hike. They also had other activities going on that had large turnouts. So to me, it was incredible to stand out, and I'm somewhere in there, and see that there are 600 other people just going on this one program. So you see these huge crowds. They're braving tough conditions. I mean, there were thousands of people on Henry Hill during the Manassas 150th. So you can see they're braving the 120 degrees, and they're not dismayed. So you're going to see a remarkable endurance from people coloring, especially these early days of the commemoration. Yes. It would be worse in a wool uniform, yes. Yeah, so. Yeah, I heard, he's mentioning that they took several casualties in the reenacting unit during First Manassas, and I would believe it. I saw some of my friends were participating in the reenactment as well, and they came back looking pretty awful. But people stayed out nonetheless, which to me is incredibly remarkable and shows your dedication that you all stayed out to take 65% casualties during the commemoration. He also had a different dynamic that is developing as these sesquicentennials are rolling out, and that is the social media dynamic. So in 21st century world, we can share, much like these podcasts, we can share our commemorations with people across the nation. So I'm sure I was not alone in eyeing my Facebook news feed constantly because, hey, if I can't make it, I can watch from afar. I can pick up videos on YouTube. I can get updates in real time from someone's Facebook page. And so the parks were very good about making sure that people from a distance could also follow, which is a pretty interesting dynamic. We also, the National Park Service, actually rolled out a full social media team for the sesquicentennial that traveled from park to park, from sesquicentennial to sesquicentennial, to take pictures, to take video, to make sure that our people at a distance could pay attention and could figure out what was going on, even when they couldn't make it to the park, which was a pretty neat thing we could have. But to focus in a little bit on our sesquicentennial, so immediately after Antietam, the next big show moves to Fredericksburg for the December 1862 commemoration. And in our planning, we had several countless meetings, as you can imagine, and had a lot of different discussions about what we should do. How do we commemorate this program, or these events? And we decided on a mixture of programming. Again, remember our goals, remember what we wanted to accomplish. So we decided to have real-time tours, again, getting people out on the field at the time of events. We wanted to have special commemorative programs. So here we see something a little bit different. We had a couple different evening programs that we took to the churches in Fredericksburg because we had such a nice venue. Fredericksburg has multiple historic churches that we could take advantage of. So here we see one of our Eve of Battle programs taking place. We had ceremonies and participatory events. So we were trying to get something for everybody. We also had a kids' tent going. So we were trying to, again, try to meet the needs of all of our groups and make sure that people are engaged in some form or another. Some of them are more intellectual. Some of them are more outdoors. Again, some appealing to kids. All of these programs in December, interestingly, were very much subject to weather. So we were on pins and needles for most of our time planning, saying, okay, this is great. If it snows, it's all over, isn't it? Happily, it didn't. We were blessed with very good weather, and only one day did it actually drizzle on us, and that was about the worst. But just to focus in a little bit on the highlights, which I think can tell us a bit more about this from sort of a snapshot perspective. So we're going to head on over. So for me, one of the greatest highlights was a procession that we had through the town of Fredericksburg itself. One of my primary goals whenever we were planning our meeting, especially for Fredericksburg, I would constantly say, I want something that's going to shake up the whole town. I came up with a pretty crazy idea, which happily the park said no to. But elements of it survived in the sense of we want to make sure that the whole town realizes something's going on. Something different is happening. Even if it's just because you're frustrated because the roads are blocked and you can't make it to where you're going. That's you remembering in a slightly more angry fashion than we'd like. But we really did shut down several streets in Fredericksburg and invited everybody to join us on a procession from the riverside, basically to show, you know, the crossing of the Union Army across the Rappahannock River, and then to move through the town and walk with us all the way to Maurice Heights. So basically following the footsteps of Union soldiers, ending up at the Confederate position in town, on the edge of town. And we included a lot of different elements to this. You see right up front that we have modern military units. Several descendant units joined us, so we had the Irish Brigade, complete with Irish wolfhounds. I'm not sure if I made a picture with the wolfhounds in there, but they were pretty phenomenal. The Stonewall Brigade descendant unit was with us as well. You see reenacting units with us. You see the Irish government represented because of the Irish Brigade's most famous role in the Battle of Fredericksburg. And then you see behind the large masses of people that joined us. There's somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 people who participated in our events that day, which, again, is just incredible. You know, we aren't Antietam. We aren't Gettysburg. And we got all of these people to come out and clog the streets of Fredericksburg and walk through town with us while the bells are ringing and the church bells ringing and us walking all the way through town. It's one of the most moving experiences of my entire life. And it gave everybody the sense, hey, we're part of something big. And this is really a big deal. Yes?
Is there a video of that?
So is there a video of that is a question. What we have is sort of a snippet view of the procession. So we had, as part of the social media team, we called up a fellow from Richmond who's excellent at videography. And so there's about a three-minute clip overall that includes the procession and focuses mostly on the program at the Sunken Road. And so check it out on YouTube, check out the park's YouTube, and you can watch it. Eventually, we do have a longer footage of it all, and we do hope to make that available whenever I get the time to edit it. So what you see has not happened for the last 3 years, so hopefully sometime soon. But yeah, take a look at the short clip. It should hopefully be enough to satisfy. But so this was probably our biggest event. But there were some other things that I thought were pretty meaningful that we did at Fredericksburg. So one of the interesting things that we decided to do for Fredericksburg, yeah, you see the motley crew of people I get to work with on a regular basis up here. We decided to put all of our park historians on all of our real-time tours. It was the only time that we had such a discrete set of tours that we could actually do it. Once we got to Chancellorsville and the Overland campaign, there was just no way. But for Fredericksburg, we had the staff, we had the funding, we could do it. And so we put everybody on each of the real-time tours, which to me was just fantastic because you got all of these different perspectives. I mean, this is really the brain trust here, however reputable they may look. Many of these people have been working. Greg Mertz here on the end has been at the park for almost 30 years. John Hennessy next to him for 15 years. Frank O'Reilly for 25 years. I mean, you could just go on down the list. So to have all of those perspectives on one tour at once was really, really interesting. And what I really wanted to share with you all is at the end of our last real-time tour, all the historians up together stood along the sunken road and talked about what the sesquicentennial meant to them, what it meant to them to be able to present these programs to the public. And for me personally, that was one of the biggest highlights of the entire sesquicentennial. It wasn't totally on the spot. John Hennessy, our chief historian, had warned us that he was probably going to do something like this, but some of us felt a little put on the spot. But we all came up with something that I thought was pretty remarkable, and I took notes, so I thought I'd share those with you. Eric, who you see on the far right end here, remarked on the size of the group. He was really encouraged that other people cared about these events. So often we get caught up and stuck in our offices and we forget that hordes of people will actually come out to listen to these stories. Don, who you see to the right of Frank, who's wearing the purple scarf, Don's right there in the middle, was on the edge of retirement. He was going to retire in the spring after decades as the park historian at Fredericksburg. He expressed gratitude for the visitors and the staff present. Me, I'm there with the short hair. You might recognize me as I'm standing right here. I recalled a reporter's question about whether I or other historians ever felt like we had the weight of all of these past generations on our shoulders that we had to satisfy, that as a historian, it was our responsibility to take care of. And I said, constantly. We constantly feel that weight and that pressure to tell the stories well and to make sure that no one ever got misremembered or forgotten. Greg, on the far left end here, smiling pretty big, said he connected this tragedy to 9/11, and he was curious about how people emerged from a crisis. And so he was talking about kind of comparing our generations to the Civil War generation and how everybody deals with crisis a little bit differently. Andy, who's second from the far right, was thankful for the passion of visitors and the staff that led us all this far. Pete, here's Pete. He's to my left, to the left of me in this picture. He talked about the inspiration that he received at the 125th as a kid and how he was honored to be on the other side of it for the 150th and had the chance to inspire that same sort of passion in other people. John, our chief again, just second from the left, said he metered the nation's well-being through their interest in soldiers and veterans, and that commemoration like this was our chance to gauge the nation, to gauge society. And he charged us all to never forget and to always honor them. And so to me, that was one of the most moving moments of the entire program. But the real-time tours that we all participated in, I think, gave us all a chance really to transcend time. And so after each of the sesquicentennials, I took a moment to write down my thoughts in the immediate aftermath. So they're a little tired and jumbled, but nonetheless authentic because of the timing. And one of the things that I wrote was how time adds an almost unexpected layer. I wrote, I could feel the gleam in Humphrey's eyes as he went gloriously forward. Humphrey's led one of the last attacks on the stone wall. The quiet desperation of his son standing between the seemingly manic Humphreys and Harm. The true meaning behind the, it is said that judgment day comes but once, quotation, all is a sunset beautifully behind us. So you can see, for me as a historian, this meant a great deal. And I think that for the visitors who were also on scene, this really meant a lot to them. They've come up to us later and told us that the real-time tours make all the difference and that our reflections also carry them forward a good deal. So, fun. And so as we explored these stories in detail, because one of the other things that real-time tours gave us the opportunity to do is to tell stories we don't normally do, to delve, very deeply into stories that a lot of times we only scratch the surface of. If you take my 35-minute sunken road tour, I can tell you it's going to be very, very fast-paced. You're not going to really get to know a lot of the characters involved. But if you walk with me for an hour and a half while we talk about Andrew Humphreys and his single attack against the stone wall, we can talk about different layers of humanity. And so it gave us the opportunity to talk a little more about what humanity is, about these people from our past, and then to learn a little more about ourselves as we see ourselves in them or see them as foreign beings. So, moving on from Fredericksburg, the next spring, we had an interesting conference called the Future of Civil War History. So this is more of an academic and public historian sort of gathering in which we sat down to talk about where do we go from here. We're halfway through the sesquicentennial. What are the questions we should be asking for the rest of the sesquicentennial? And what should we be looking at in the years to come after the sesquicentennial? Hosted by Gettysburg College, and it really was an interesting collaborative moment. Some of the biggest questions that they raised that I want to touch on as we hit one of the midpoints of our conversation is, how do we stay relevant to modern audiences? So how is it that as our thinking about wars change and about people change, how do we stay relevant? And then how do we incorporate broader stories? How do we talk about topics that are difficult to discuss? How do I walk into a room and talk about Ferguson and relate it back to the Civil War in such a way that we can all come together and talk about it and not get upset? So just a brief interlude, and then let's move on to Chancellorsville. So we had some challenges. We can go ahead and change the slide. Some challenges when it came to Chancellorsville. Our next battle, firstly, being back-to-back with Fredericksburg, we were all pretty exhausted. And then secondly, right before Chancellorsville hit, of course, so did the government sequestration. So we had to take our original schedule and break it down considerably. So we then had to choose, okay, which of our programs are most important? Which are going to have the largest impact on people? How do we do everything and keep it as simple as possible? So when we're bringing in modern artillery units and setting off fireworks on the riverside at Fredericksburg, at Chancellorsville, that's not even thought of as an option. So you'll notice that our sesquicentennial observance changes a little bit with Chancellorsville. It's going to look a little bit different. We also had the challenge of absolutely nowhere to park anybody, which when you're talking about the behind-the-scenes stuff, that was huge. So we had to work through that a lot in our own meetings. But our goals for Chancellorsville specifically were to push beyond our normal sites and stories, to highlight the story of Stonewall Jackson, which looms large over the Battle of Chancellorsville, but then also to look beyond that story, because Jackson so often overshadows everything else that takes place that we don't understand Chancellorsville's place in its larger context. So we wanted to do a little bit of both. We wanted to have special programs, evening programs, and things that were a little bit different from the real-time tours and talks, but we had to do it on a very limited budget. So we came up with some interesting solutions. One of them for our evening programs that was, again, one of the main highlights was the Lee Jackson Bivouac program. So we just set up a very simple tableau. This is my colleague Pete here in uniform tending the fire. And the idea was just to invite everyone to join us around the campfire as Lee and Jackson had discussed 150 years prior. So that night you see our large crowd gathering up to hear us talk about just what sort of decisions Lee and Jackson were making, how that influenced the battle, why it was so remarkable, and why it really mattered. And then our next evening program, the very next night, if you want to push us forward, was to light up the mountain road. So we go from Jackson's brilliance to Jackson's wounding as Jackson rode out on a reconnaissance in front of his men 150 years ago before this night. And this was another logistical, not quite nightmare, but to light up the mountain road just right, just at the very right time. So we lit it up as though we were following Jackson's progress, and so the audience on the other side of the trees could see these lights going as Jackson went. And then they saw them extinguished as Jackson went back. Don't ask me what was happening on the mountain road at that point in time, as I was in charge of these lanterns. But we extinguished them, and then we paused and lit everything again so that our visitors could walk down the road and really walk in Jackson's footsteps, experience how dark it was, but also to see how his path was lit up, and just essentially to understand a little bit more of what happened while using the environment itself to set a certain tone and a certain atmosphere in which to really evoke a better understanding of what took place there. We give Jackson wounding tours every day in broad daylight, and I'm standing at the spot where Jackson was wounded, looking back toward where the 18th North Carolina was that shot him, and you can see everything. I can tell you, 150 years after he was wounded, in the pitch darkness, you couldn't see anything, even without the trees that had intervened. And so you really got a sense for the environment and the understanding why the 18th North Carolina fired on Jackson. So again, we're using a little bit of the environment to set the atmosphere. One of the other highlights of the Chancellorsville anniversary was one of our real-time tours. Well, actually, it was not a real-time tour, I take it back, but one of our special tours that was giving us a different sort of experience, if we want to advance the slide to here. All right, so we wanted to give people access to places that we didn't normally get to. That was something we tried to do on all of our anniversary programs. And at Chancellorsville, I think we succeeded wildly. We took people on what was perhaps the first ever public walkthrough of the entire length of Jackson's flank attack. So we started at our tour stop, we crossed through private property, and as you see right here, we crossed through a lot of woods, and we made it all the way. It was a 4-mile hike, and it taught us not only a lot about Jackson and his experience. We did line everybody up, and we had about 200 some people, maybe 250 people. We lined everybody up in a straight line in the woods and tried to march forward. And we got lost. And I don't mean that the visitors got lost. I mean that we got lost. And it was my colleague Frank O'Reilly and I leading this tour, and I had to stop after our confusion. And I looked at Frank and I said, "Frank, find our flags. We don't know where we are." And so, learning experience for us as well as the visitors, because we were thoroughly lost. But not only was this a historic tour in that it was the first public tour to go from one end of the attack to the other and back, but it also told us a lot about our visitors. So we learned about the historic experience, and we also learned about our modern people, because Frank and I had flagged out our route through the private property that we were going through, and we were very adamant that everybody follow us. You know, we've got the funny hats, we should command a little bit of authority and follow us while we go through private property. And I can tell you that there were several people who followed no directions whatsoever. They were so excited, we couldn't believe it. They outpaced us ridiculously. They were way in front, they'd figured out our flag system, and they just had us. So especially on the way back, they were just dashing forward. And Frank and I were looking at each other, what do we do with these people? But in reality, we were so excited ourselves. These are people who are so interested that they can't even wait for us, that they're going to be way up past us when we stop and start talking, and they're going to have to walk back, and they did it consistently. So it told us a lot about the enthusiasm of our visitors, which was an important lesson. It also told us the importance of military discipline and just why you put your soldiers through so much training, because I can tell you, people don't listen very well when they get excited or when they get in a difficult situation. But moving on through our highlights, if we're on to our next spot here. So we talked about getting beyond the Jackson story. So often people don't even realize that there's an extra day of fighting, primary day of fighting, after May 2nd, after Jackson is wounded. So we wanted to make sure we put a spotlight on May 3rd. On May 3rd is one of the bloodiest mornings in American history. One man falls killed, wounded, or captured every second for the first 5 hours of the morning. So this is a pretty important day, and this truly defines the Battle of Chancellorsville and determines the outcome of it. So we started off with a dawn walk from Hazel Grove, what became the Confederate primary artillery position, to Fairview, which walked you between some of the most serious artillery and infantry fire. And we started at dawn, and there were some of us who were wondering if anyone was actually going to join us, especially those of us who reported for parking duty an hour before the tour. But it was incredible. We had a ton of people show up at 5 o'clock in the morning. The sun wasn't even up. They were traipsing through the woods in the dark with flashlights to join us for this program, which we heavily admired. But this is one of the programs that was also had an added layer of sort of neat, more like an interesting layer added to it, because we utilized living historians. So we talked a little bit earlier about reenactments on the battlefield, and reenactments are not allowed on the battlefield. And part of that reason is because it adds a sort of different air when you have men firing at each other on a battlefield. when it's actually on the battlefield ground. But what we did instead, using living historians, was to still give you that sense, to some degree, it's more of a hint of it, of what it would be like to be on a battlefield when people are firing. So whether it's artillery or infantry, and on this program we used both, to give you a sense of what does it sound like for the cannon to fire. And one of the neatest experiences was having these living historians out in the woods beside you, because a lot of the fighting on May 3rd happens in the woods. And so what is it like to fight in the woods? And keeping in mind that our woods are not as thick today as they were during the battle, it was incredible to watch these fellows fire, and the smoke just hung. So you think, well, yeah, of course it's smoky, but the smoke really goes nowhere, especially in the early morning atmosphere. So that told us a little bit interpretively, but it also gave our visitors a real visual demonstration of what fighting in the woods would be like, why it was so terrifying for these soldiers, and just, again, the overall experience. So when we start to look at the lessons learned for Chancellorsville, because one of the beautiful things about having four sesquicentennial programs to plan is that you get to learn from each prior anniversary. So for me, I learned from Chancellorsville, which I already had to some degree before, just an unrelenting admiration for our visitors and for my colleagues. For the visitors who showed up at 5 o'clock in the morning, for the visitors who stayed up until 10 o'clock or so on the mountain road with us for the real time of Jackson's wounding. And so in my notes from this commemoration, I wrote about how lucky I was to know, and I put in quotes, such people. And I was citing a quote that I had found from a North Carolina soldier while I was researching my programs for Chancellorsville. It was a North Carolinian whose account was abysmal about the battle. And so I immediately started reading through and going, well, this is entirely unhelpful, thanks, but no thanks. But then I was reading through it, and I realized, wait a minute, this has almost more value than all of the other accounts, because he's writing, quite honestly, he doesn't remember what happened during the battle. But what he remembers is everything about his comrades. And so he writes these details about his friends, the people that he knew. And then he writes that he was so honored to know such people, and he underlines such people. And to me, that was one of the greatest accounts I'd ever found. I'm not sure I actually got to use it in any of my tours, but it stuck with me ever since because of what the people he served with meant to the soldier. So I drew on that a little bit in my own reminiscence. But overall, you'll see a little bit of a shift in the commemorations that I would say starts a little bit here, somewhat from necessity. We couldn't have the big style ceremony, the big style commemoration, because it simply wasn't possible for us. So our main ceremony that we had on a very shoestring budget was not highly attended, and it was almost discouraging to be there for it. But all of our real-time tours, as you saw 250 people traipsing through the woods, were heavily attended. And so we got to see a sense of what our visitors were looking for, what they wanted, and it was that authenticity of experience. They wanted that real-time tour. And so we started to then tailor our efforts accordingly. People want real-time tours. People want to learn more about their history, more than they want to sit in chairs and look around at the scenery. Well, let's go for it. Let's have more tours. Let's get people out on the ground, walking and exploring and asking questions. So we're going to focus more, as the time passed, on the kind of gritty information and the details. So moving on from Chancellorsville, I did not participate, but I did attend the commemoration at Gettysburg. So we want to just have a brief interlude. Forgot to put that in my notes. So this is our group from Hazel Grove to Fairview, walking between the two. So you can see definitely no lack of attendance. But scoot on. All right, so I took this picture while standing in line waiting for Pickett's charge to take off at Gettysburg. To me, this was one of the highlights of the entire event. But really, I was inspired by the entire event because I was so inspired by my fellow visitors. As we're walking around, I saw this massive, determined group moving from one tour to the next tour. And they had shuttle buses at Gettysburg because it would be impossible otherwise. But they couldn't keep up with the volume of people. So firstly, that's impressive. Secondly, when the shuttle buses failed, people were not at all deterred. They just picked up their stuff and said, all right, well, we'll walk. And so I'm walking with these huge hordes of people as we traverse the entire battlefield because the shuttle let us down and we needed to get to our next tour stop on time. And we did it. And everyone was thrilled to do it. So, again, to me, that was extremely inspiring to tell us that our society still cares. And there's thousands of people who still care a great deal. But I was struck most specifically by Pickett's Charge, which the Park Service had their program basically to be, we're all going to line up, And there's going to be a line, you know, on the opposite side, on the Union side, to wait for us if you don't want to charge across this field. But otherwise, we're going to walk as one huge group across that field. There's no chance when you've got thousands and thousands of people to really do a real-time walking tour, but we can all walk in step. And I know when I first looked at the program and when I first joined that line, I was a little bit afraid because it seemed to me that we would look like a bit of a mockery, that our formation would be really terrible, and that someone was probably going to trip, and that was going to make us look bad, and then there was the matter of those fences. And so this was a horrific assault that cost a lot of people their lives, and here we're going to bumble our way across the field. And so for a while, it gave me a lot of pause. But then the more I thought about it, the more I realized, look at this sea of people who are interested in commemorating Pickett's charge. This is what they have to do to commemorate. And so our intentions, in many ways, I think, made up for our terrible formation. And we did, in many ways, bumble our way across the field. But we did it in such a spirit of remembrance that I think it was something that everyone on the field will never forget. And as they never forget, I think they will constantly be remembering the soldiers who also crossed that field. And so I don't think we were a mockery. I think, actually, this was a brilliant idea because it was so experiential, because it was a participatory act of commemoration. And so I applaud Gettysburg for what they did with Pickett's charge. And I think in the end, it was fantastic. But to steal our glory back from Gettysburg, we're going to move on to the Overland Campaign and our last two battles to commemorate. You can go on and scoot forward. This, in many ways, was our last chance, and we knew it. So we wanted to pull out all the stops and do everything we possibly could. I can tell you that we were thoroughly exhausted when it was all finished. This was a signature event, a signature National Park Service event, which meant for the first time we were the highlight of the year, the Overland Campaign. So us, Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania, partnered with Richmond, partnered with Petersburg. We were the main show in 2014, which meant that our battle anniversaries loomed a little bit larger. Our logistics had to be a little more thorough. And it also added another component to it, which I'll only briefly touch on, which was called reverberations, in which each of those parks sent staff to distant communities to raise commemorative events that Memorial Day weekend. I was part of the contingent that went to Michigan, and it was pretty neat. We went to the Henry Ford Museum, and we had really at least 1,000 people, if not more, out on the green for that program. It was pretty remarkable. And so you could see us not only looking at our own parks, but also that whole idea of spreading out a little bit more. We also, as an added component to this, added those new exhibits at Chancellorsville Battlefield Visitor Center. They finished a whole, I think, 2 days before the anniversary was upon us. We were a little bit nervous about that. But those new exhibits also include the Overland Campaign story interpreted in such a way that it's never been interpreted before. They really are fantastic. If you weren't on the trip, I highly recommend them. But then we had a whirlwind of programs. So if we had real-time programs before, we blew all of those numbers out of the water. We had an exhausting schedule. It was designed so that people almost had to choose which events they were going to go to. Although I was still impressed by the number of people who said, well, we saw that you had all these programs, so we just took 2 weeks off of work, and here we are. And I was floored by that. But there were people who did it. And part of our reason for having this whirlwind of programs was to show the campaign and the style of warfare had changed, and so too our commemoration had to change as well. Again, we focused on these real-time tours. We focused on this exhausting pace. And we noted that the interest in our anniversaries had not waned. A lot of people had predicted, well, by 2014, everyone's going to be tired of your sesquicentennial. But our visitors proved that they were not. So some of our highlights include this image right here. We had real-time sunrise programs at the Tap Field and at Bloody Angle. And while everyone showed up quite bleary-eyed, you can still see we've got a pretty sizable group in the hundreds for each of those programs, which, again, when you're showing up at 5 a.m., is pretty incredible watching the sunrise. We have added atmosphere for many of those programs, especially for the sunrise and Tap Field. We had artillery presence, again, to sort of add this layer of living history for us. Again, as we start to look at interest, you want to go ahead and advance the slide one more time for us. This was a program, we're going out of chronological order, by the way. This was a program on May 11th. Which I had proposed. It was Mother's Day, and I'll admit there was some hesitation that we weren't going to get anybody to turn out for a program on Mother's Day. And I said, well, if I was a mother, I would show up. And so we led an all-day hike sort of reminiscent of Antietam, but this time without a central break. Antietam had a break in the middle, and I said, well, this will just be for the hardcore people that'll pack their own lunches and walk 7 miles with us. And so I assumed we'd have about 30 people, and said tops 50, so we planned for 50 people. I figured there'd be 30, and then 86 people showed up, 75 of whom made it all the way. Not everyone made it for the photo at the end, but 75 was what we had at the very end. So you want to talk about dedication? Our visitors were dedicated. Have no doubt about that. Move on. One of the other things that we learned that came from the anniversaries is we learned a lot of new things. So we learned stuff about our history that we didn't actually realize. So the traditional story with Emory Upton's attack on May 10th at Spotsylvania is that Upton was this up-and-coming officer who had this brilliant idea of a different style of attack that was going to punch through the lines and break through the Mule Shoe salient and then spread out and develop from there. And that had been our interpretation traditionally for Time Out of Mind. But then we started to dig into it, and more specifically, I'm going to point out Eric Mink from RSF, our cultural resources manager, because he was responsible for much of this digging, although I sat in his chair and said, yeah, that sounds good, most of the time, because he started to look into it and said, I can't find the accounts where Upton is saying, yeah, I had this brilliant idea. And Upton was the kind of person who would probably say, yeah, I had this brilliant idea. And so we started to look into it and figured, actually, there are several people who had a pretty serious hand in this attack, and we think that other people in the upper echelons of the Sixth Corps actually planned this attack and then said, it's about time that Emory Upton got his brigadier star, so we're going to send him forward with this attack. And so we wonder if the attack was actually planned and then handed to Upton. We can't confirm it, but we certainly can't confirm that Emory Upton had this brilliant idea. So that changed dramatically our interpretation of this one event. Very, very neat stuff. Details to some degree, but really revolutionizes how we look at Emory Upton and this entire attack. So learning a little bit of new things. And then as the anniversaries continued, we realized that Upton actually was not promoted on the spot either after his attack. So basically the two primary tenets of our traditional interpretation of Emory Upton's attack at Spotsylvania had serious flaws in them, which we were delighted to find. You might not think so, but we were very excited. And then we also got to work with some other topics. We had a tour called Building the Mule Shoe Salient that was not about a battle at all, not about an attack. It was all about how this Mule Shoe Salient was constructed in the middle of Robert E. Lee's line and why, because it just answers a question that a lot of people had. So it gave us a chance to look into the battlefield landscape and kind of move beyond the basics. But one of the most moving things that we had as part of our commemoration at Spotsylvania was 22 hours of a continuous presence at the Bloody Angle at Spotsylvania. It represents the 22 hours of constant fighting that occurred there, which has always been one of the biggest touchstones of our entire park, to think of the dedication of these men to fight over one small space for 22 hours on end. Their commitment to their causes, their commitment to fighting it out on that little scrap of land, to us is incredibly remarkable. So we had several tours that looked at the ebb and flow of the fighting on that day, on May 12th of 1864. But then we had what we called the Silent Sentinel program, and that was that we had one person with a flag on that ground for 22 hours. So we all traded out. Everybody took different shifts. I will proudly say that I was the first to volunteer for the midnight to 4 a.m. shift. So Frank O'Reilly and I, Frank is right behind me in this picture, traded off and on from midnight to 4 a.m. But somebody was there, starting with our superintendent, who's actually to the far left in this picture. She started us off first thing in the morning on May 12th, and then four of us, my colleague Peter also joined us. He joined us about 3:30 in the morning. We all wrapped up with one last shift at 4 o'clock in the morning. But we had different rangers who traded in and out all day long just to say, we recognize what happened here. We're watching. We're remembering. Something is happening constantly. Even though we know no one's going to show up for a tour at 1:30 in the morning, fighting was still taking place here. So I can also tell you that the experience of being at the Bloody Angle at 3:30 in the morning, at 2:30 in the morning, is incredible. I can also tell you that my joints hurt very badly and that the soldiers started to peel off the monument multiple times because we were just that tired. But it was an excellent moment to be able to reflect on what had taken place there, to stand in silence and just look at the ground and look at the landscape. It was very moving. That night, we also had a candlelight vigil before my midnight shift began. And the last quote that I read, which stood out to me perhaps the most of any of the Spotsylvania quotes, was from a man named A.B. Pattison. He was from 7th Indiana. And he said, "In the charge, Watson received a slight wound in his arm. Poor Hugh Jameson was killed. Can it be that one so young, sober, and brave is taken from us in a moment, stricken down in death? Poor Hugh, I loved him as my own brother. And you are gone, but I hope to heaven, for you were good. He's buried a few graves to the left of McAdams and in the same row." Just after entering, Harry received a flesh wound in the calf of his leg, just touching the bone. "I'm glad, for it may save his life. He has done his duty." Then Corporal Canfield fell, shot through the face, killing him instantly. He never spoke. Another brave soldier gone heaven. Father, spare us from more sorrows, for our griefs are more than we can bear. My best men are falling around me, and I am untouched. So just from a soldier who's going through this, enlisting every single person that entered the battle and either did not return or returned wounded. And all of these, keeping in mind that these are probably his close friends. And so trying to think about, what does all of this mean? And so my greatest message from the candlelight vigil was to say that, yes, each of these candles can represent a light, but it also represents the ideas that these people had, that they presented, that in many cases they died for. And those ideas didn't extinguish, even if their lives did. And so it's our job to pass it on. So in the end, and this is an image of that candlelight vigil, three of us spoke and traded all of our ideas and our different perspectives on what took place here. And in the end, to sum it up, I think I can say that we learned an incredible amount from our sesquicentennials about our visitors, about the war, about our resources and our stories, and ultimately about ourselves as individuals and as a collective nation. There has been a question posed in the historic community, the big historic community, as to whether our sesquicentennial commemorations were anemic, is the word that was used. And I would argue, at least from my experiences on National Park Service programs, it was not. We had several downsides. I've mostly focused on the positives, because I'm an optimist, but there were downsides. My harshest criticisms of our sesquicentennial would be that we often segregated our programming. We talked about telling a broader story, and so we told it, but we told stories of race and slavery in one category, and then we told the battlefield stories. And I would have liked to have seen us mingle that more. We did, in many cases, but not all the time, and I would have liked to have seen more of that. And I think that people in general, people who don't pay attention to the Civil War community, did not get a sense of the sesquicentennial as much because there was no national movement, there was no national organization as there had been for the centennial. So a lot of efforts were more localized. And so I would say that was one of the other main downsides of the sesquicentennial, that you can't, it's harder to sweep up the entire nation without a national campaign. So those, again, the two largest downsides. But I think we saw a lot of real positives. We saw this dynamic, vibrant, very smart group of visitors, almost the same faces on many different occasions, joined by locals who came out for each individual battlefield. You could recognize a lot of the same faces. It was wild to go to different anniversaries and see the same people that I'd seen at Second Manassas in 2012, and hey, it's Appomattox, and you're the same people. They actually started an email list, which was pretty intriguing, these people who had just met and connected as people with a common interest from our sesquicentennial. So you see people forming bonds on the battlefields. You saw people who wanted to participate, who wanted to have that real, authentic connection with people from the past, people who wanted to engage with tough issues. I can't count how many times I asked a tough question of somebody, and they always answered. People really wanted to talk about things. They wanted to walk the ground in real time to have that experience. So some big questions we can think about or talk about in question and answer time would be, what does this tell us about society and how society views the Civil War? So some of the same questions we started with. Are we in a good place as students of history? So things to think about. The thing I'd most like to close with, and then we can maybe come back to those questions, is to say that, you know, the past is hard. We've been grappling with it for the last 4 years in terms of a sesquicentennial, but truly we've been trying to understand the Civil War since it happened and even while it was happening. How do we cope with events on this magnitude, with death on this scale? And so close with one anecdote from May 10th, the night that we had not only Upton's attack tour, but we also had our main commemorative ceremony program for Spotsylvania Courthouse, and I was running around doing logistics things, and I overheard a father and son walking along the battlefield trying to get in place for the program. And the father looked at his son and said, "You don't know the word kill yet," which is ironic considering where you are. His son was very little. And they looked at each other, and then they paused. And then the father looked and said, "You can learn that word another day." So as we look to find meanings on our battlefields, it means something very different to all of our people. And so for me, the true lesson of the sesquicentennial was that the light of everyone who gave all or lost all or gained everything, that light lives on. We keep it intact, and we always will. It's our job. It's the National Park Service. And I hope that you all will as well. So happy to stick around for any questions, comments, anything like that. Yeah, so the question is about how much history is being taught in elementary schools. And I can tell you that unfortunately, or fortunately, it's been a long time since I've been in elementary school. So I don't remember. I know that I did have a lot of history. A lot of it was very basic. And I know that I did not find history to be very engaging until really I reached high school, because that's when you could really dig into things. And it wasn't so much about memorizing things. It was a lot more about, what do I do with this information? How do I use this information? And so I can tell you that, you know, in our park especially, I don't direct our education. It's my colleague Pete, who you saw a couple times up on the slideshow, that he's working very hard to try to make sure that we have outreach programs, that we get into schools, that we bring schools to our park, because we think that students will do better if they can see how history is being used, if they can see where history happened and really engage with it on the spot. And I think that's going to be one of the answers. I can't speak to how the education system works at the present, especially in Virginia, because I did not go through it. It's been a while. But, yes?
She's like a
shining light. Sure. And in answer to your comment, I would offer hope in two different ways. One, to say that one of the things that I've most noticed about our visitors, just the average visitor who walks in off the street, although they do tend to skew older, one of the things that they say is, "Man, I don't know why I wasn't interested in this when I was younger." And so I think some of your interest simply develops as you get older and have more time to reflect on life. Yeah, and the other thing that I would say is, firstly, I'm only 25. I'm interested in history, and I'm joined by countless other people my age, younger, and even slightly older. One of the things that I'm lucky enough to do around the park is to help to assess internship applications as they come through. And sometimes I get to help screen with interviews and such for internships. We have a large group of very passionate people who are excited to serve as park interns or want to serve. And we unfortunately turn away far more than we get to use every year because there are so many people who are my age or younger who are very much interested in the Civil War. So I don't know that it's sweeping the nation necessarily, but I would say there are people from all over the country who are very much interested, who are young people who want to be engaged. I also saw at Appomattox, so I'm going on to a third thing, I know. I saw at Appomattox just a couple weeks ago that it was spring break. There were a ton of kids there. A lot of families had decided to bring their entire family to the Appomattox commemoration. And so I was very encouraged by that and by the presence of kids at other commemorations too. So I think there is some interest. It might not be as much as we'd like, but there is definitely a group of young people interested.
But it's rare that it doesn't come from somebody they know and love.
Yeah, I hear almost constantly that, yeah, it's you have to try to inspire other people. I hear all sorts of people who say that the reason they got interested is because their parents dragged them to Gettysburg or dragged them to Williamsburg or something like that. And they always say dragged as the key word there. So drag your family's places. They eventually enjoy it.
Now, how often do you go into the public schools to give talks like this?
So unfortunately, I don't often go into public schools because we have, of course, Pete, who does our education. And I would say that that's an increasing thing. So he goes rather infrequently at the moment, but he's working on developing a lot more programs. He and one of our education contractors, Becca Capobianco, are working diligently to do more. We actually just rolled out this year a virtual classroom to allow people who don't live nearby who can't get visited in their classroom by a ranger or visit the park easily, to engage with the park's stories and resources in a really interactive way. If you have any interest in it, I highly recommend checking it out. You can get a link to it on our website. And so we are actively working to reach out to kids. The difficulty that I think they see is that a lot of times schools are restricted in the amount of say, field trips that they can take. And so even if we're just down the road, it's a lot harder to come by, or it's harder to come by and spend a lot of time when they're heading on to other sites on their trip. So, but we do what we can. And I think we do all right, and we're constantly trying to do better. All right, thank you all.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.